So what are the greatest experiences of loss? When I started to reflect on this question, I had to start by looking at our beginnings in this country. When I think about all that we've been through as people of African descent, from our beginnings here in this country, I would say that it's been an existence, a life, if you will, that's really been framed by loss. So loss of the promises. You know, we were brought to this country, brought to this land with promises. I've been able to trace my family roots to the Loyalists and the Maroons. And both, if you know anything about the Black Nova Scotian history, you know, and I'm not going to go into any of that. I don't want to. It's actually rather depressing when I think about our history, how we came here. And the broken promises, I would say, have led to a history and a legacy of loss. And what we're seeing today is the accumulative effect of that loss. So loss of opportunity, loss of hope, loss of dreams, loss of even a sense of entitlement that we're entitled to certain things. And those are some of the things that I see that members of our community are fighting around every single day. So I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with what you're saying, Wanda, and one of the areas of loss that I would point to is loss of agency. We as a people in Nova Scotia have never been given agency as a people in Nova Scotia. Our struggle to survive has been as isolated as our communities were isolated here in Nova Scotia. And it's only up until really recently that people of African descent here in Nova Scotia have begun to demand and request that agency. Another loss for me is the loss of economic opportunity. It's the economic engine. It's being a part of the economic engine in this country, and particularly in Nova Scotia, that I think is at the very root of the issues that we're facing here today. Wanda talked about promises, and if we had received those promises when we arrived here in Nova Scotia, we would have equally participated in the forestry industry, the fishing industry, and the farming industry here in this province. From those very beginnings, if we had those promises fulfilled, we would have, as you know, Nova Scotia going into Confederation and the formation of this country was one of the richest colonies in all of the colonies. And that came through those three main industries. And if we had have been given the promises that were made, we would have, and the opportunity to equally participate in those economies, some of the issues that we're facing today would probably have been avoided. And so agency and loss of economic opportunity, I think, are two of the major losses from the very beginning. The other, loss of self, loss of we always knew who we were and we always had an identity. But who we were and who our identity was confined to those isolated communities in which we found ourselves. And it was only through our interactions with each other that we were able to define ourselves to ourselves. Because others in positions of power and authority defined us. But we never agreed with those definitions. And so within our own communities, and you know, there's blessings that come with things. You know, there's always a bright side or a good side to every coin. And I think it was because of the isolationness of our communities and the absolute need for us to be dependent upon each other is that the sense of community grew and grew stronger. And we were able to, like I said, define ourselves, develop our own culture. And it was a culture of sharing, it was a culture of giving, it was a culture of mutual support for each other, because we all understood all of the challenges that we faced when we left those communities. So those are some of the real early things that I would point to.
First off, thanks for coming out tonight, and thanks, Ellen, for inviting me. It's really an honor to be on such an illustrious board. And when I looked at this question, loss, I mean, of course, this book about Eddie Carfry, Irvin's older brother, it's a story about loss. It's about Eddie growing up in Africa and Eddie losing Africa, losing his community, losing his world, losing his family, losing his sanity in the end, and then his journey to try and recover that. But I thought I would answer the question from a different point of view, from my own point of view. And it's a loss of culture and a loss of history. Because as a white Nova Scotian, I grew up here, all my education is here. I have a social anthropology degree from Dalhousie, so I studied this kind of thing, but I never studied Africville, and I never studied black Nova Scotian history. And it wasn't until 2008 when, as a freelancer, I had a run of articles on African Nova Scotian history for Black History Month. And I sat down, and the first thing I realized is that I didn't know any black people in Nova Scotia. And for somebody who's been here my whole life, and my family has been here since the 1750s, it struck me as an extremely strange situation. But then I went even further into my ignorance and discovered that I didn't even know where to begin for African Nova Scotian history. What are the stories to look into? What are the issues to talk about? And so flailing around in that ignorance for a while led me to the path that eventually led me to meet Eddie Carfry and to start hearing his story about Africville. And so I learned a lot about Africville, and not just Africville in its last days, the hard stories, but also the extraordinary stories about Africville when Eddie was a boy, and the culture and the energy there, and even before that with the Colored Hockey League back in the early 1900s, and just a tremendous rich vein of history that I was really excited to discover. And also, you'd mentioned the Maroons. Like, I'd never heard of them. I don't know how you get a full education in Nova Scotia and don't learn about the Maroons, but it was such a dramatic story about these, you know, these swaggering warriors coming over from the West Indies and just sort of making this profound mark that echoes today in Nova Scotia. So for me, the loss aspect is that as a Nova Scotian, I'm not kind of given access to my full history, because I think black history in Nova Scotia is not just a separate sort of thing for black people to learn about, which is how it's often kind of framed, but a thing, it's part of our full historical story. Like, I don't make a distinction between German history in Nova Scotia or French history. It's just Nova Scotian history. And I think we've lost a tremendous amount by sort of excluding black history from the broader story and the rich culture and amazing stories that we just we don't know about.
Can I add? Can we continue with it? Yes, because I think there's a lot more to say about loss. And it's been interesting to hear what the brothers are saying from your perspectives. And the one piece that I haven't heard that I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about, and that's the loss of education and educational opportunities. So when I think about, and on so many levels, so first of all, you know, the segregated schools were legal in Nova Scotia until 1954. I mean, think about that. And it wasn't just that there were segregated schools. I'd be okay with segregated schools. I'd be okay with segregated communities even. I live in one. If they were separate but equal. But that's not what segregation means. So the segregation of our schools, the segregation of that education, and the inadequacy of the education, and then that affects every single thing. Education impacts employment opportunities. Employment impacts, you know, where you live and how you live. So if you think about the social determinants of health and our health and our well-being, those loss of those opportunities through education and then through employment travels with us, tracks with us. So it's from the cradle to the grave, essentially, because it also then has an impact on your quality of life at each stage of life. So that's one piece of the education, and then you've just mentioned another piece, and that's the whole what we learned. So there's an absence of teaching about African Nova Scotian history, and I absolutely agree with you that it's all of our history, but we weren't taught it either. We were not taught our history. We were denied. So that's another loss. We were denied learning about ourselves. What we were taught about people of African descent was very negative. So who wanted to be an African? You know, we didn't want to be African because all we heard about Africanness was bad, was negative. That's what we heard through our education system. So we're just now redressing that. And when I look at you look at African-Canadian studies courses in the public education system now, they're even not, I would say that they're not being valued through the education system the way that they should be. So they're not, now I shouldn't speak to this. I should let our chair of our school board speak to this.
Nobody else has a problem speaking to it.
I better stop there.
You know, I didn't jump right into Africville because I knew my good friend John here would want to speak to Africville and speak to Eddie's experience in Africville. But that is the loss when one loses their community. And I tell people all the time, it's not about bricks and mortar. It's not about bricks and mortar. It's about all those things of value within your community, of growing up where you knew everyone, everybody's child, right down to your line went all the way back five generations and you knew everybody. And you lose that. You lose the sense of being somebody important. You lose your sense of worth. You know, Wanda didn't want to go into the history, but I am going to touch on the history in the fact that when the Loyalists came in 1783, there were 3,500 freed blacks. But at the same time, just to put it in context, here in Nova Scotia, the white Loyalists who came were allowed to bring 1,500 slaves. Slavery was alive and practiced here in Nova Scotia. At the time of the destruction of my community of Africville, the landowners in Africville were my grandparents, which only has them two times removed from slavery. My great-grandfather, who we called Uncle Johnny, was born at a time just after slavery was abolished here. Slavery was still being practiced in the United States, but slavery had just been abolished here. And the reason why I mention that you have to have a perspective of the people of the time. So if you're that close, if you're still that close to that evil, evil institution of slavery, on one hand, you have a slave owner mentality, and on the other hand, you have a slave mentality. Coming in with my grandmother, who was the postmistress in Africville to do her business at Halifax North Post Office, walking along the street, and she'd have my hand, and if white people approached us, she would pull me to the side to allow the white people to pass. That's the mentality. That's the loss of person. That's the loss of self. And you know, it took two generations for us to overcome that loss in the late 1960s and 70s when we began to question our civil rights here in this province and our demand for our civil rights as equal people here. You know, 1970 was the last house was bulldozed down in Africville, and that's not that long ago. You know, when the province was formed and the land was given out and the businesses were established, this province was ruled by magistrates in different counties throughout the province, and each one of those people, almost to a person, were slave owners. So the power elite here in the city of Halifax, town of Halifax, were slave owners. Joseph Mon, who sat on the governor's council here in Halifax, moved up from Louisbourg after the French was given back Louisbourg, and with the founding of Halifax, he came to Halifax and he was a slave trader. He traded slaves between Quebec, Nova Scotia, the West Indies, and the United States, and he sat on the governor's council. So when I talk about loss of agency, it all comes from that. And you know, we have not been able, we are still trying to recover from that great loss, even today. And Wanda talks about education. In our education system here, everyone thinks that we have a public education system, an equal education system. Well, that's not true. It's not true because of the loss of all the things in our history that today, our African Nova Scotian children, there's a widening gap of outcomes between our kids and kids who were coming from the white community and the upper middle class and upper and rich communities. The gap is widening, it's not closing. You know, I've just come back from the United States at the National Conference for Black School Educators, and where they're talking about we need to do something to break the pipeline. And the pipeline is our children who are not achieving in school and going directly to jail. The chances of a black child getting a university education is far outshone by their chances of either ending in jail or dying. The odds of those two are far higher than the odds of getting a university education because of the gaps in achievement, the gaps in outcomes. Because within our, and this is something that I work on every day with my school board, 75% of the African Nova Scotian population resides within HRM. If we don't get it right here in HRM, in Halifax, we're not just affecting some children, we're affecting an entire race of people, 75% of them. So we have an obligation, a duty, a huge responsibility to close that education gap. But as long as we continue to think about funding the way in which we currently think about it, it's not going to happen. Because education, the way it's done through the government, you're given a budget, and then you're to distribute it through all the work you do within your school board, and it's huge. We need to have targeted funding, targeted for those children. Education needs to start from the cradle and end at the grave. And if we don't start thinking in that way, we're only going to see the problem get bigger and bigger and bigger. We're already suffering from higher unemployment rates, and we're suffering from lower achievement at university level, at the high school, junior high school, elementary, junior high. And if a child isn't reading to learn by grade 3, they will struggle for the rest of their academic career. And for children of African descent, the odds are that they will not complete high school. And you need to have at least high school to push a broom now. We're in the knowledge age. We're in the knowledge age, and you need grade 12 at least even to push a broom. So those losses are continuing to be felt today. We need to find a way in which to break the cycle.
And I wanted to add the opposite of loss. We're talking about loss, but the opposite of loss is gain. And while Africa is being destroyed, while all of, you know, these things were happening, other people were benefiting. And as a white Nova Scotian, you know, interviewing Eddie, I spent 40 hours sitting knee to knee with him in his trailer in Africville, going over his whole life, over the Africville story. And it got me thinking about my own ignorance. And when I thought about racism before I met Eddie Carvery, I was aware that there was racism. Okay, but what does it mean? I don't really see it. You know, I'm a white man. It doesn't affect me. I couldn't really understand what it meant as a tangible sort of thing. And basically, my understanding was: do you remember those Part of Our Heritage Moment commercials of the Underground Railroad that ran over and over in the 90s? That was my understanding of race in Nova Scotia or in Canada generally, which is that there was slavery in the United States, and they escaped with the help of charming white Canadians to get up to the north, and they were free here, and they got out, "Pa, you're free. And this was my impression, is that, wow, we're great. We did a lot of great things. We freed the slaves. Well done us. And so to get into the real history and to learn about the slavery here, the slave auctions on Grand Parade there, and the horrible abuse, but also more specifically to see that sort of wins-loss column, I found it interesting to study because Eddie was born in October 1946. My father was born in September 1946. And they were born, my dad was born in the North End, Eddie in Africville, so they could have seen each other had they, you know, thrown a baseball high enough. And while Eddie grew up, you know, first the school was destroyed in Africville when he was just a little boy, and he was forced into the segregation, which was, of course, a one-way street that black people of Africville had to go up into the white schools and accommodate and adjust there. It wasn't a two-way street. And then, of course, Africville was sort of driven into the ground with the dump and the slaughterhouses. And all of these disadvantages kept lining up on this side. Meanwhile, my father, who's, you know, a just in sort of ordinary white Nova Scotian, his father had, you know, sort of put enough money aside that he could get a university education, so he went to university, he got a job, and I inherit that, you know, born zero, having done nothing, I was born into a lot of advantages, a lot of accumulated advantages, and not just in my lifetime or my father's lifetime, but going back generations and generations. And after, you know, spending this much time with Eddie and also with Irvin and other things, you come to see that it's so long-standing, you know, it's been built up over such a long amount of time, but because we don't educate ourselves about it, we don't know about slavery in Nova Scotia, we don't know about how things started, how things were assigned, how, you know, white people in the South Shore got Shelburne with its cove and fertile land, black people got Birchtown with its less fertile land, and eventually were driven off there, and that's repeated over and over. So I think the other side of the loss is the gain, and that you know, it's the advantages that my ancestors built for me weren't always built fairly in a way that I would, you know, want to support. A lot of time I would stand with Eddie in Africville rather than with my own ancestors in other parts.
You just, can I just jump in? I'm sorry.
Sure.
You
sure.
Want to stop us? I'll stop.
No, that's okay. We're moving into the area of my second question has to do with some of the systemic factors. So you've already entered into that zone, but if you want to continue on, that's fine. I think folks would be agreeable to that too.
So let's jump into that.
Yeah.
Into the systemic.
Well, yeah, basically, I'd be asking you to think about the systemic factors that you consider either directly or indirectly causal to the issues facing Black Nova Scotians, either in the past or currently, I guess, would be more.
Well, I think John has just laid it over nicely, looking at systemic racism and how systemic racism systematically disadvantages racialized people, so it's disadvantaged First Nations people in this country, in this province, and disadvantaged people of African descent, and while privileging white people. And so the systemic racism and discrimination, past, present, and unless we make the change, will be our future. You know, it will be our future, it will be your future. It will be our children and our grandchildren's futures unless we do something about it. And John, you were saying, you know, how do we educate ourselves? And I'd like to pull that back and say, you know, it's not about us educating ourselves. I think that systems and organizations and institutions have some responsibility here, and not just in terms of the education system. I'm thinking both the media. You know, that's where a lot of people get their education is through the media, so a lot can be done through the media. Oh, you're a journalist, too, aren't you?
I am.
So the media, the education system, churches. When I think about systemic racism, one of the places that it played out historically is in the church. You know, we have an African United Baptist Association because black people weren't allowed to worship in the white churches. And so in every single area. So the systemic racism and discrimination, that's where it is. And until we get really serious about challenging and changing and breaking those barriers and really using the privilege, so you talk about having the privilege. We know the privilege is deeply, deeply embedded. Privilege and power. People don't give it up, right? You don't give up your power and you don't give up your privilege. What I say in the classroom is, you know, students often feel really guilty. They feel guilty about the past. They feel guilty about their ancestors. I'm hearing John talk a little guilt there.
I don't feel guilt about it because I feel like I was born just as blank as anybody else. But I think it's important for me to be aware of that. Life is easy for me, but not...
And why it is.
And racism and sexism are invisible to me as a white man because
it
always works to my advantage.
And so understanding the why of that, but then what do you do with that privilege? So when people feel guilty about it, I say, you know what, guilt is not helpful. Go to confession if you need to, and it's not. But then move to action. Use the power and privilege. Irvin talked about, you know, Privy Council, being in... You know, who are the decision makers? Who's forming legislation and so on? That's where some of these changes have to happen. The people who are making decisions, who have the power and the privilege to make those decisions. And if you have the ear of those people, or if you are those people, then what do you do with that? How do you use that privilege and that power to break the cycle? We're talking about generational cycles of oppression. And honestly, if we don't change it, who will?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, systemic racism, and you know, the term is that there is racism, but there is no one person you can point to and say that person's racism. It's these systems that we have in place that have been developed from a time when racism was blatantly practiced, and the feeling of superiority on the part of white people in developing the policies and procedures within those systems were ones that would detract from persons of African descent. They were just automatically geared that way. Even to some of the questions that were asked, you know, would be asked on interviews. And it's quite interesting that, I mean, for an example on it, I mean, we've been here as the only people that have been in Nova Scotia longer than us are the Mi'kmaq people, the first peoples. We've been here as long as the French, and we've been here as long as the English. But if you look at all the corporate boardrooms in Nova Scotia, you will not find one of us. I could be wrong. Maybe Senator Oliver might sit on one board or two. I'm not sure. But I'm talking significant numbers. You will not find us there. You will not find us at the tables of decision making, those decisions that impact on our everyday life. You will not find us at the tables. And so when we talk about systemic racism, until such time as we are there to voice our opinion and to voice our concerns, things will not change, because white people sit in positions of just automatically being in power. I was, again, I'll go back to the conference in NAPSE, and there was one of my teachers was there, and she was white. And she was relating to me an experience that she had had. She was in a room full of people of African descent, and her whiteness came out in terms of positions of authority and just being who she was, of privilege. And she said she didn't even realize it until some words came out of her mouth. And then she had to look around the room, and she said, "Oh my God, I'm in the minority here, not the majority." But she just, even though she was in a room full of people of African descent, her attitude and her thinking was still coming from a position of privilege, of being in the majority, even though she's surrounded. And so that's the kind of problem that we have with systemic racism. Those people in those positions don't see anything wrong. They don't see it. They're not looking through our lens. So they're looking through a lens of privilege, and they're seeing everything is just great. And at the meantime, we as a people are suffering. We as a people are banging at the door to try to come in and can't get in. And yet the people in those positions are seeing everything as being just perfect. There's no problem here. And that comes from systemic racism. It comes from positions of power and just feeling that there is no problems here. You know, when you try to talk about systemic racism, and when you start to talk about succession planning, oh my gosh, don't talk about succession planning, for goodness sake, because that might mean that you're going to have some people of African descent move up in the ranks. You know, even which everyone agrees you must do succession planning, but when you start talking about succession planning in order to have your senior management team be reflective of the community in which you serve, a lot of people have a lot of problem with that, and they find different ways of counteracting that, you know. And even the government of Canada, in terms of its multicultural policy, multiculturalism has done nothing to knock down all of the disadvantages of people of African descent in this province. They use multiculturalism as a lens to say we are a great country, but if you look through that lens, you won't find people of African descent from Nova Scotia. You will find recent immigrants to Canada, and these people are coming from positions of a lot of times people of positions of power, well-educated, because our immigration policies are geared towards who's coming into Canada. And if you're a person of color, you must have either wealth, good education, or already coming from a position of power from the country you're in. The refugees that come in are very small in number. We should be admitting more. We should be admitting more people of color who need a place. Canada's a big country. It's not even nearly full. Not even nearly full. And yet, our immigration policy, along with our multiculturalism policy, still leads to the systemic racism in this country. And I really, really believe that. On the backs of those who have suffered, on the backs of those who have fought the fight, on the backs of those who have brought a consciousness to this country of Canada, but those folks still do not benefit from that struggle. They made the country aware, and the country has flipped that around for whatever reason, so that those folks still are not benefiting to the degree they should be benefiting in Canada. A lot of it to do with systemic racism.
Thank you. John, do you have something before we're going to open the mic up some for the audience, and then after that we'll take a break. And I'm sorry, I have to apologize at this point. I've been remiss. We've had regrets from Reverend Lakita Porter from East Preston, who was to join us tonight, but there was another situation she could not attend. So I apologize for not mentioning that earlier. John, would you like to wrap?
Sure. Yeah, I don't know a lot about the sort of causes of the systemic racism, but one of the effects I see, I had to kind of learn it by reverse engineering. I lived in Europe for most of my 20s, mostly in Scotland, and there's you know, ample racism there, but it's a different kind. And the British National Party clearly says we want England for the English, whites only. They have a clear stated policy of racism. And you have the history of Nazi Germany, you have, you know, contemporary issues about Germans not liking Turks. But all these issues are right out in front. You can see them. People talk about them. There's, you know, it's there. When I came back to Nova Scotia, what struck me was the invisibility of it and the amnesia in white Nova Scotia that this was even an issue, that there was even something to deal with here. That you know, like, I don't think we even know what racism means or what racist means. And I think, well, I'm not a racist, but I think there's degrees, you know. I thought maybe we could break it down like murder. There's first degree, second degree. So we've got like first degree. There's like cross-burning racists, and then there's like cross-the-street racists. And there's not many of us that are cross-burning racists, but there are a lot of us that are cross-the-street racists. You're walking down the street, you see three black people walking towards you, you just cross the street. You're at the shopping mall, maybe you look at them a little longer because maybe they're going to take something. These sort of subtle, built into the system things. And so the only ways that I've come to see that it's not exactly amnesia, it's not been forgotten, it's more of a denial, is do you remember the movie Beetlejuice, where they would say the word Beetlejuice three times and the monster Beetlejuice would hop out? I found two code words in Nova Scotia, and I urge you to try them out, that will reveal the monster. The first we touched on is Africville. Like, since I've started talking about Eddie, talking about Africville, I've had people, I was at a book signing, a woman came up to me and expressed her opinion that people in Africville just should have organized better and they could have resisted the demolition. Yeah. And I said, you know, I explained that I didn't think that was the case. And she ended up calling me arrogant and storming out of the chapters. I've been sitting, being interviewed by someone, a journalist about this, at a cafe in downtown Halifax. And the people at the table next to me just jumped into our conversation and started explaining to me how it wasn't right what I was saying, and that Africville was this, that, and the other thing. And it was just like, you say the word Africville, and people will come in this end. The other word is, I'm working on a biography of Edward Cornwallis now, and that's the other code word. You say Cornwallis, as Irvin knows, when the school board pulled the name Cornwallis down from the school last year, that's the other word that shows that it's not amnesia, it's not totally ignorance, it's willful denial, it's choosing not to see these issues, choosing to frame the world in such a sort of damaging way that privileges the majority and doesn't the minority.
Thank you.
And part of the problem with that, when it's done in this country, it's so polite. It's so polite. You know, they do that and smile in your face and say, but you know, we're fine here. And part of the problem is, and this is another, we go back to loss for a second, part of the problem is we've been taught to believe it as well. We've been taught to deny racism as well. We've been taught to believe, you know, if we can just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you'll be fine. You know, we've been taught all of these things as well. And that's another part of the loss. That's another part of the cumulative and the impact of it. I really like the cross burning across the street.
It's worth noting just as a
I've noted it.
As an example of this, is we did have, there's been one case that I know where there's been a human rights person jailed for burning a cross. And it didn't happen in the 1950s. It happened here in Nova Scotia last year, the year before.
Last year.
And I've, as a journalist, you deal with it, and you have people, and I can almost start to think, yeah, well, maybe it wasn't racist. Maybe it was just a sort of personal, but then you're like, no, it was a cross burning, and the things they shattered. Like, but I can understand how your mind starts to wander. You start to think more favorably of the situation.
But even the way that was framed.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was just these...
Yeah, just a couple of young folks.
Yeah.
They were just poor white guys, you know?
Yeah, ignorant.
Ignorant. They didn't know any better.
They didn't know any.
You know, did you listen to the interview? They just didn't know any better.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way that got framed. That's not the first lawn that's been a cross burned on.
No.
The first one that got some media attention. Yeah. Okay? Mm-hmm. The first one where there were charges laid.
Right. I mean, we only have to look at the burning of the building at the Black Loyalist site in Shelburne.
Yes.
We only have to look at the vandalism at the Black Culture Center. We only have to go to the Halifax Commons and walk by and see "Nigger Die" written on the panel there. And I took pictures of that and I sent it to the city. I said, you know, what's going on here? And that was put on there at the same time as the Mi'kmaq were holding their powwow on the Commons. That's why I was there. And, you know, it took them 4 or 5 days to come and remove that graffiti off of that very offensive language off of a public piece of property. So it's there. It's still alive. And, Wanda, I like when you talked about, you know, we as a people and the impact that it had on us as a people. Of course it did. Of course, when my grandmother pulled me by the hand and pulled me to the side, It impacts when you are so oppressed, both not just physically but mentally, when you're told day in and day out that you're less than, this is your place, and don't expect to go no higher, you know, it does, after a while, it does impact on you. Why do you think one overseer with a whip and a gun could control 200 bulky, strapping black men working in a field? It wasn't because of the physical presence of that person, it was because of the mental work that had been done to us as a people to make us think that that's where we belong. Slavery was an institution that wasn't controlled by the whip and the gun. Slavery was an institution that was controlled through mental destruction on the part of our people. And so it takes a long, long time for it to get over that. And, you know, we as a people are still struggling with that. We as a people are growing out of it, but we still, there's so much more work that needs to be done in terms of our people feeling that they can be all they can want to be. You know, they'll say it, ask them the question, they'll tell you that, but when it really comes down to it, there's always questions of it. You know, for my own personal experience, the election of Barack Obama as President of the United States, you know, I always thought that, yeah, maybe it could happen. Mm-hmm. You know, but I always said, never in my lifetime, maybe in my children's lifetime, maybe in my grand, but never in my lifetime. It wasn't until he was elected as President of the United States that it finally registered home with me that yes, it can happen. That actually a person of African descent can be the President of the United States. Even though I consider myself to be a forward-thinking person, but in my hearts of hearts, I think I was still a victim of that inferiority complex and thinking, oh no, we could never achieve that. So, you know, there you go.
Thank you. I'd like to open a little time for questions at this time. Margaret, if you'd... So, we have some time, so if you want to ask a question or if you want to make a comment, please raise your hand. Margaret will bring the handheld. I ask you to be brief, mindful that there are others perhaps want to speak, and let's go.
Hello, I'm very... I don't know.
Is this on?
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, yes. My name is Judy Haven, and I teach at St. Mary's University. I wanted to know, I have a lot of questions, but I'd like to know your feelings or your views on the Nova Scotia Human Rights Commission, on what it does or what it doesn't do.
Next question.
Do you need to shut the mic off here? The recorder?
I'd like to jump right in there on the Nova Scotia Human Rights Commission. The Nova Scotia Human Rights Commission was an institution that was established in Nova Scotia. The Halifax Human Rights Advisory Committee was a group that charged themselves with seeing the establishment of a human rights commission. The Halifax Human Rights Advisory Committee was the ex facto voice of the community of Africville. So with that in mind, the Nova Scotia Human Rights Commission was formed but given no power. The act of racism on a person, onto another human being, should be a chargeable offense under the Criminal Code of Canada. But when you establish a body that's only power is to negotiate and to mediate, what are you saying about the act of racism itself? That it's not as big a crime, it's not as big, and the reason for that is because it's being perpetrated upon we, the people of African descent in the province. So that's my thoughts on the Nova Scotia Human Rights Commission.
Is there another question?
No, I wanted to answer.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry.
You really want me to answer this?
Yes, I do.
Honestly? I think the Human Rights Commission is a vehicle that I think because of a lot of systems and processes and so on, it's not as effective as it can be. When you think about, I was actually looking, I went to a document that I have and I'm trying to remember, I think I have something here that says the number of cases, but I can't, oh, here it is. In 2006, visible minorities compose 4% of the population of Nova Scotia. And they account for 22% of human rights complaints. Okay? This was as of 2006. And the vast majority, 78.2% of those cases, are about employment. Now, this speaks volumes. And of course, we know that in Nova Scotia, the visible minority population, 50% of them are people of African descent, okay? So that says a lot about the types of cases going forward to the Human Rights Commission. But we also know that the processes that the commission uses, as Irvin's just mentioned, you know, moving to mediation. So a lot of people, a lot of times what happens then, the cases get mediated, so the issues never go public. Unless there's a public board of inquiry, very few cases go to a public board of inquiry. And when they do, the process takes so long. So if you think about anyone that gets the nerve to lodge a complaint, because it takes a lot of confidence, takes a lot of nerve to actually go forward with a complaint, because for the most part, we're internalizing these issues. So when someone finally decides, you know what, I think I have a case, I'm going to the commission. But how many of us would take a case anywhere and wait 5 or 6 years for it to be resolved? You'd give up. You'd give up long before you got to a hearing. And most of the cases are settled before there's a hearing. And usually, typically, there's a gag order, so no one else benefits from the issues and the outcomes, unless it goes to a board of inquiry, and so few do. So there's a lot that needs to happen there. 10 years ago, I was part of a committee that did a whole review for the current lieutenant governor was the CEO at the time, and we did a whole review around the province. They're doing a review now, and so the person who's reviewing called me to do an interview last week, and I said, well, have you looked at the report we submitted 10 years ago? Hadn't heard of it. I nearly went through the telephone. I was so angry because I'm thinking, you know, this feels like such a waste of time, because we made really good recommendations about ways that they could address and shorten the process so that people had more expedited complaints and so on. I don't know what's happened. You know, our job was to hear what people had to say. And we didn't hear much positive from around this province about the commission. And we were specifically looking at racialized communities, but broader issues as well.
Anyone else? Yeah, thank you for the first half. That was great. Now the second half would be as good. I had an education question, Bo. We're all products of Eurocentric education. With a question, I guess I had two things. One was to hear a bit more about the Afrocentric curriculum that Black educators are talking about. And second, I guess specifically to Irvin, how successful has the grade 11 curriculum been? That's where it's introduced the African diaspora textbook. I think it's been on 3 years now. And I'd be interested to know, you know, how many have been able to take the course, not necessarily numbers, but if you do have them, that would be great. And then the other part of that, of course, is should this not happen earlier? Mm-hmm. For the Black community, rather than for the time a young man or a young woman are 17 years old?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they're at high school. You know, whatever their makeup's going to be is already there. They're at high school. It needs to move down to elementary school. Elementary school is where it needs to start, so that when those young minds are forming opinions and thoughts, that it's there that they can have this very good wealth of information. Now, in terms of the program, I can't give you numbers as to the number of students that are taking it. I know that they are popular courses, and they are very popular with the white students in the school, as well as the African descendant students. Are they being as promoted as they should? That's a question. I don't have an answer to. My gut reaction is no, that they're not. Is there enough? No, there isn't. Why isn't there mathematics being taught that have an Afrocentric point of view? Because that's where math started. The great University of Thebes. I mean, like science, why doesn't that have an Afrocentric slant to it? We need our children to be interested in the sciences. You know, a Bachelor of Arts degree is great if you're going to go into literature or into, you know, something like that. But in today's society, in today's modern society, it's the sciences. And yet, how do we engage our students to be interested in the sciences? Because I'll tell you right now, they're not right now at no great numbers. And one way of doing it is to let them see themselves in those areas of studies. And there are lots of examples of it. So we need to promote more what's being done, but it needs to be expanded, and it needs to be expanded at a far faster pace than what it took to get those two courses within our public school system. And I've got to give a disclaimer here. The Halifax Regional School Board does not set curriculum. That's done by the Department of Education. And we make recommendations, but we do not set curriculum. That's done by the department. But we need to move quicker, you know. It's just, that those are my answers to those ones.
Hi, my name is Gloria Benimer, and I really enjoyed all comments. And this isn't a question, but I have rather a comment. And as many of you can tell, I'm neither white nor black. I'm CFA. and have had much share of...
CFA, is that colored from away?
Yes, exactly. You got it, Irving. And everything that each one of you has said has been very insightful, and I agree with all of it. But I also like to make a point that when we as a society have racism, we all suffer. We cannot go forward. We cannot actualize our full potentiality until we are all on equal footing. It does not make sense. And it is every one of our responsibilities, morally, ethically, socially, that we all have to take action, as Dr. Bernard said, that it's time for action. Guilt is only going to actually stop me, whereas action is going to make me inspired so that I will want to do something. And I really urge all of us, spread the message, because I hear all the time, there is no racism, no prejudice. Okay, really? Where are you living? But it is so systemic, it is so organic, that it is not easy, as it was easy to distinguish, this is not the tap, this is not the water fountain for you to drink. That was easily distinguishable. Today, it's not distinguishable, and it is widespread across every strata of our society. Thank you so much for organizing this event tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment.
Can I just mention the Race and Well-Being book?
Please. I'm going to let Dr. Thomas Bernard speak for a moment, and then we will take a 10 minute break. There's coffee, hopefully, God willing, if the coffee maker works, it's a new thing, I don't know. And then we'll be back for round two, sort of, so to speak, and which will be a little briefer. So, Dr. Thomas Bernard.
Okay. So I want to mention this book. It'll take more than a minute because I have to tell a little story. So this book, Race and Well-Being, my colleagues and I published this book. We released it in 2010. And I actually organized two book launches for it. And for both those book launches, did a massive media blitz. And I didn't do it myself. I actually had our media person at Dalhousie do it. And we did not get one media person show up at either book launch. It was shameful. It really was shameful. The book, Race and Well-Being, comes out of a research project, a five-year project funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. And we examined all these issues we're talking about this evening. We looked at racism and questioned racism as a form of violence. And we were looking at the impact of witnessing and surviving racism. The question was, what's the impact of witnessing and surviving racism on the health and well-being of black men, their families, and communities in Halifax, Toronto, and Calgary? We talked to over 3,000 African Canadians, and this book highlights some of the findings. It was a quantitative and qualitative study. We did get a very positive media launch of the project when we first got the funding, and had a really nice press conference, and the media came out, and we got some really, I found out, it was after, I analyzed it after the fact. The project was released a year after 9/11. And so it was the one news story that was on that day, other than reports of the one-year anniversary of 9/11. So when the media, we did get media, positive media coverage for the launch of the research project when we got the funding. And this one phone call that I'll never forget, I will take this memory with me to my grave. But there was a phone call from a Canadian, a white Canadian male who was living in the States, and of course he was staying in touch with home through the CBC, heard the interview, and he phones me, and I'm excited. Thank my God, you know, this is great, you know. Someone living in the US wants to hear about this project, so I'm phoning him back, and he's phoning me. We're missing each other, and we finally connect. And he says, Dr. Bernard, I don't know why you're wasting the government's money. Why in good conscience would you take this money from government to study black men when you know they're all criminals and you know they all belong in jail? I was so traumatized by that phone call, and I hang up the phone and I call my partner at home, who happens to be a black man, and I said, you won't believe the call I just got. I was physically shaking. That's how traumatizing it was. And George says, Wanda, that's all the more reason for you to do this work, so you don't suck it up and get back at it.